You're listening to ReachMD XM233, the channel for medical professionals. 85% of American adults gamble. How do you know when it has gotten out of control? And when is it an illness? Welcome to the Clinician's Roundtable. I am Dr. Leslie Lunt, your host, and with me today is the chair of the APA Committee on Addiction Treatment, Dr. Petros Livonis. Dr. Livonis, among his many professional duties, is the chief of addiction psychiatry at St. Luke's and Roosevelt Hospitals in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on this program, Leslie. It's wonderful to be here.
So how do you define pathological gambling?
Pathological gambling is an impulse control disorder, according to the DSM. And the criteria for giving the diagnosis of pathological gambling really mirror the criteria for substance use dependence, the substance use disorders, and actually the severe form of substance use disorders, which is, of course, substance dependence. There are several criteria in the DSM, but we can really organize them along four dimensions. First of all, there is tolerance, increased amount of money gambled in order to achieve the desired excitement from the gambling activity. Second one would be withdrawal, feeling irritable and restless after attempting to cut down or stop gambling altogether. The third one is an internal preoccupation and compulsive behavior when people actually, all they can think about is the gambling activity and they can really not stop themselves from going out there and gamble. And the fourth set of criteria has to do with external consequences, personal, familiar, occupational, financial, or legal deterioration. Overall, the core of the definition of pathological gambling is loss of control, that you have lost control of your life over the gambling behavior.
Okay. So very much is parallel to the substance use disorders.
Yes, yes, it is.
How common of a problem is this?
It is common. We think about 1% to 3%, according to different studies, that meet criteria for pathological gambling. Gambling is legal in 48 states. There's a huge revenue, $72 billion a year. And what I consider to be the most disturbing statistic is the fact that pathological gamblers spend 25 hours per week on average doing the gambling activity. 25 hours per week on average. That's enough to really ruin a person's life.
Now, is there any data that different cultures have different rates of gambling problems?
The only consistent one has been the fact that where it's legal, we see greater rates of pathological gambling. Now, this is, of course, the classic chicken and the egg situation, because gamblers may be attracted to areas where where gambling is legal, and that may increase the rates. It's not necessarily that having it legal would increase your risk of becoming a pathological gambler. What we do know is that the nature of the gambling activity does vary widely among different cultures. So in some cultures, we may have cockfighting as the expression of gambling. In another culture, I live in the city of New York, so I know that very, very well, it could be the stock market.
Well, now, is pathological gambling more common now? It seems that there's a casino everywhere you look, where growing up, I don't recall ever seeing them outside of Las Vegas or maybe Atlantic City.
That is very true. And, of course, there's the biggest casino of all, and that is the Internet. I have a patient of mine here who is hooked on the Internet sites that allow you to gamble. And although she's a very, very smart person, and she knows that she has no control of whether the odds are really as advertised on the Internet, she doesn't seem to be able to control the activity, and she ends up losing a considerable amount of money and time on the Internet gambling.
So other than money and time, which granted are very important, what other consequences do you see in patients that have this problem?
It depends on the stage of gambling. We identify four different stages in the trajectory of somebody who suffers from pathological gambling. The first phase is usually a winning phase, stimulated by initial wins. The person is exuberant, very high. There are very little in terms of consequences. The second phase is called the loss phase. And this is a phase where the patient tries to recover money by chasing losses, leading to a downward spiral. That's where we see the family relations deteriorating. That's where we see the vocational relationships deteriorating. And the person is really start feeling really depressed and anxious. The third phase is called the desperation phase, and that's when the person may be doing really stupid things, including criminal activity, stealing, fraud, conning people in order to recover the money lost in the gambling activity. And that's a very, very dangerous period for a person with very significant legal and social consequences. Then the fourth stage is called the hopelessness phase, and that is characterized by depressive symptoms and often suicidal ideation. That's when the person has stopped acting, has given up. We don't see any criminal activity anymore, but we see very significant psychopathology. We see significant depression, sometimes leading to suicide.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to ReachMD XM233, the channel for medical professionals. I'm Dr. Leslie Lunch, your host, and with me today is addiction expert and Betty Ford scholar, Dr. Petros Livonis. We are discussing pathological gambling. And Dr. Livonis, are there any medical consequences to pathological gambling?
Yes. Hypertension, peptic ulcers, migraines are the most common medical comorbid conditions. They can also be helpful in terms of the assessment of pathological gambling. Somebody who had not been suffering from any of these disorders and then starts showing migraines and hypertension may be a good time for a clinician to do a test or a checklist to find out if the person may be also suffering from pathological gambling.
So there are screening tools available to us?
Yes, we do have screening tools. The most commonly used one is the South Oaks Gambling Screen, SOGS. It is a 20-item self-report, and it takes about 10 to 20 minutes to complete. However, there is a much shorter one. It's called the Early Intervention Gambling Health Test, 8, which is an 8-item, 5-minute questionnaire. And this is a really easy one to do in an office. It can be found on the internet. It's in the public domain, and it's quite helpful.
Well, interesting that they didn't call it 7, right? When would you suggest somebody in general practice or general psychiatry practice, when do you even think about screening somebody for pathological gambling? I have to say, I don't do it routinely at all.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it routinely for everybody either. I know that this is not exactly politically correct what I'm saying, and my colleagues in the pathological gambling area would say I would do it for everybody. But if we were to do a screening for absolutely everybody for all these disorders, then we wouldn't have time to treat the patient. So I would say if you do see some of these medical comorbid disorders, if you see some of the psychiatric comorbid disorders like mood disorders, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, substance use disorder, or the personality disorders, the cluster B personality disorders in particular, like borderline personality disorder or narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, histrionic personality disorder, any one of these disorders, then your index of suspicion goes up for pathological gambling. And you may very, very well want to screen. Also, if you live in an area which is quite where pathological gambling is quite prevalent, like, for example, in Las Vegas, as we said before, then you may want to be doing the screening more routinely.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Now, I've heard you say, Dr. Livonis, that mice are smarter than men. What do you mean by that?
This is probably one of the most difficult ones to explain without some kind of visual help, but I will try to explain this. What it is that when we train mice to respond to pleasurable stimuli, let's say we have 30 different doors and door number 26 is the one that has the reward behind it, and you know, after a while the mice will be trained and they will know when they hit door number 26, they get all excited in terms of their dopamine level, in terms of their reward pathways. But if they hit door number 25, they feel absolutely nothing. Or if they hit door number 27, they feel absolutely nothing because they know that it's only one in 30 and only door number 26 has the reward. Humans do not really respond the same way. If, let's say, you're playing the lottery and the lottery number that wins is number 26 and you have bet on door number 25 or on the number 25, you do get quite excited about it. You say, I almost got it. I was almost there. The same thing with door number 27. So you train yourself to be excited for a whole range of numbers. So effectively, the odds, the way that your body metabolizes the odds, it's not like 1 in 30. It's more like 5 in 30 or 6 in 30. Any one of the numbers around the number 26 will give you some pleasure and reward. There's a whole distribution around the particular number. You see on TV that you say, I got 3 out of 4 numbers, or I got 5 out of 6 numbers. And, of course, that gives you very, very much the impetus to play again and gamble again. Well, a mouse would say, well, I didn't get it. I don't care if I got 1 out of 5 or I got 4 out of 5. It's the same to me. I just didn't get it.
Interesting. So does superstition come into play here?
Oh, yes, that's a whole different kind of problem. And this is a superstitious beliefs. Superstitious beliefs go under a general category of cognitive distortions. Cognitive distortions are things that make somebody who has predisposition for gambling gamble even more. So people feel that there are such things as good luck objects like animal parts, rabbit this and rabbit that. There are particular routines that people do that feel that increase their chances of winning in a particular game. Athletes quite often have a whole routine before a game that feel that it will increase their chance of winning the game. And some of these behaviors and routines may play a positive role in a kind of a psychological sense. If you believe enough that something will happen, you may increase the chance of happening. But from a cold statistical perspective, that's simply not true.
Thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
I want to thank our guest, Dr. Petros Livones. We have been discussing pathological gambling. I am Dr. Leslie Lunt. You've been listening to the Clinician's Roundtable on ReachMD XM233, the channel for medical professionals. For comments and questions, please send your emails to xm@reachmd.com. Thank you for listening.